Welcome to a KNIA KRLS Special Edition News Magazine, the 2014 Iowa House District 28 race. I'm joined here by incumbent Representative Greg Hartzell from Columbia, a Republican, and Democratic challenger Megan Sir from Knoxville. Welcome.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Dr. Bob.
Glad to have you here. Well, let's begin with you, Greg. Would you please give us a couple of minutes of your background and why you're running for office?
Sure. Well, just a little bit about my background. My wife, Angie, and I have been married 21 years, and we've lived in Marion County for 20 of those 21 years. We have 10 children, 3 boys and 7 girls. I have a background in information technology. I was in the corporate world for 12 years dealing with designing systems, dealing with federal compliance and state compliance issues, designing systems that dealt with that. The last 11 years, I started my own custom fencing business to spend more time with my family and give me an opportunity to get to know a lot of the people in the district. And as far as why I'm running, well, there's been a lot of concern for the future of our state and for the future that our kids will inherit in this state. And primarily, I'm concerned about the direction that our state seems to be heading, both economically and culturally. You have a lot of politicians that seem to have the mentality that government can solve just about everything. And you have politicians that think that you can tax your way to prosperity, and that the way to multiply wealth is by continually dividing it and redistributing it. And you have politicians that are constantly pushing mandates and commands and dictates, and it seems like they're pushing more dependency than they are opportunity. And so I'm on the opposite end of that scale. I believe that government primarily exists to protect our individual freedoms, and I insist primarily on smaller and more efficient government that makes life easier for families and to thrive, and creates opportunities instead of dependency. One of the concerns, I think, too, just real quickly, is that it seems like the cost of government at all levels, federal, state, and municipal, is beginning to exceed the cost of the private sector to pay for it and still thrive. And so that's some concerns. That's things that concern me as far as why I've got involved in the race.
Megan, could you give us a couple of minutes on your background and why you've chosen to run?
Sure. My husband Michael and I live here in Knoxville. We have 2 little girls, Isabella and Madeline. Both the girls attend public school here in Knoxville at North Star. My background is I'm a labor and delivery assistant, a doula for over 21 years. I also worked in the corporate sector. I worked at Principal as well for several years before my husband Michael and I decided to move back to Knoxville and raise our family here. He does work with KNIA KRLS, and we both decided we wanted to be closer to our family so that our children could grow up surrounded by their family and with a smaller community. Both my mom and Michael's parents live here in town. My sister-in-law lives here in town. We live, work, and play right here in Marion County. I decided to run for, the first reason was for our public school system. With the lack of funding and the lack of allowable growth, I decided it was important, not just for my kids, but for all of the kids within our district, to have adequate school funding. And the second reason that I decided to run was access to mental health care. We have a crisis in our community, and not just our community, but throughout our state, where there's not adequate access to mental health care. And when my opponent voted no twice for funding mental health care, I decided it was time to step in and volunteer my time to give a voice to the other people throughout this district.
Megan, why don't you continue? I'd like to ask your opinion. Does Iowa have a good business environment, and are there things that can be improved?
Iowa does have a decent business environment. There are things that can be improved. For our small businesses, many of them get along quite well. Our corporations got the largest tax cut in Iowa history. So when you hear about the new tax cuts, those went to our large businesses and corporations. We really have a problem with adequate workforce, and there's not enough people to do the jobs that are necessary, and the training skills need to advance so that the workers can match those jobs that are out there. If we were to revamp our infrastructure as far as broadband and Wi-Fi and expand that, that would create more business opportunities within our state. That also create more job opportunities within our state. If we were to take care of our road funding and start working on our roads and bridges, that also would put people back to work. I think businesses are doing fine, but workers are struggling. And not only in our district, but throughout this state. The governor was ordered to reopen the Iowa Workforce Development Centers, and that has not happened. We haven't had the funding, and the funding hasn't been appropriated to reopen those facilities. So while I'm at the doors, I hear a lot of people saying they're unemployed, not because they haven't been looking for work, but because it's a tough world out there right now. And we need to provide those services and that training for those people that do want to seek employment. And if we were to redo our infrastructure, that would give a lot of great jobs for our district.
How about you, Greg? Does Iowa have a good business environment, in your opinion, and are there things that could be improved?
Relatively speaking, yes, we do, especially when you compare to other states that have really poor management like California and New York. Comparatively, yes, we are better than those states. However, we can do better. And, you know, when you looked at our next door neighbor like South Dakota and see how they are taking off economically in North Dakota and other states, you know, we're not doing so great when you compare to those. And you look at some of the trends where you're seeing a lot of economic growth in states across the country, you'll notice one common theme, and that is that those are consistently low tax, low regulation, and even low litigation states as well. So small business sure could use some help as far as not having the chokehold of government upon it. You know, we have experienced economic growth, but if you look around, we're moving at a snail's pace. We are constantly rated from the taxfoundation.org as being somewhere in the 40s out of 50 states as far as being a business-friendly state or having a business-friendly climate. So there's a lot of other factors besides just the tax and regulatory side as well. But, you know, it's just one of those, I've heard this said before, where money is best treated, it will flow, and where people are best treated, they will go. And we need to make sure that Iowa is a state that treats our business and industry with with respect and doesn't punish them for success. And we need to make sure again that we have adequate workers that they have the adequate skills to fill those employment opportunities that our employers have.
Well, Greg, why don't you continue? Tell us how you support Iowa farmers.
Well, a couple things here just in the legislature this past year in the legislature, legislative session. I worked to restore the landowner liability protections that was stripped out by the Iowa Supreme Court in the February 2013 Sally versus Stewart decision. That had a lot of rural landowners and farmers up in arms. Because with just the stroke of a pen, the Iowa Supreme Court took away their liability protections that had been in statute for 45 years. And so that was one thing that there were special interests that were working hard to keep that from coming to the floor. And in fact, they was successful in getting it, having it die in before the second, or I'm sorry, excuse me, they got it past the second funnel, was able to kill it before the second funnel. But we were able to resurrect it in one of the funnel-proof committees that I sit on as government oversight. So that was one way that supported farmers and rural landowners, but also have given strong support to our renewable fuels effort as it fuels the ag economy. I've continued to fight for private property rights, especially making sure that government is not abusing its eminent domain powers. We have a situation in Clark County right now that we had a bill specifically dealing with that. We have a situation in northern Iowa with Rock Island Clean Line that are wanting to go across 1,250 tracts of farmland against the wishes of the farmers there that we're battling as well. Also working to make sure that the EPA, the federal government, isn't continuing to push a heavy hand in imposing onerous rules on the family farms and driving them out of business. So there's just a handful of areas where I've shown support for our farmers in Iowa.
Megan, how do you support Iowa farmers?
Well, I grew up on an Iowa farm. My dad was a farmer, my grandfather was a farmer, my great-grandfather was a farmer. I have a really long history of farmers within our family. Currently, everybody supports our farmers. Our farmers like to be great stewards of the land. Our farmers are working for conservation practices as far as, you know, they want to keep their topsoil in place. They want to make sure that the nitrates they are putting on are done at the right time so they're not running off into the land and waterways. We, as people here, subsidize our farmers, and we're proud to do that and help our local farmers. But there are some things that they have to give back as well, which is making sure their soil does stay in place, making sure their waterways are maintained, and that we can have clean air and clean drinking water. We talk about government overreach and regulation, but with our farmers, they like to have that direction. They like to know what they can do to protect their land as well. We have seen our Lake Red Rock silt in, and that comes from topsoil. I've driven throughout the counties and saw all of the runoff from the fields and the farmland. We did bring in two different people to talk about farm field runoff as well as protecting their soils on their land. Francis Tickey came in as well as a gentleman from Des Moines, and at the time when he came down from Des Moines, Des Moines had to chlorinate their water so much because of the output that was coming into their waters. And I think this is a community issue. This is something that everybody wants to be a part of. Our farmers also benefit from CRP and are maintaining our wildlife habitats, and that's something that all of us can be proud of. Our REAP funding helps our farmers. I was at a farm last week where they did solar panels, 296 solar panels. So farmers are on the cutting edge and on the front lines of being innovative, and it's because they care.
Why don't you continue? Iowa roadways are in trouble. You alluded to this before. Do you have any ideas how to fund road improvements and better maintain our roads?
Sure. They had a task force that came together and studied the roadways and what needs to happen. And there were 10 different options out on the table as far as how to fund our roadways. So we don't have to create ways to fund our roads. Those positions and ideas are out there. There are many different ways to fund our roads. The one everybody seems to be stuck on is gas tax. We all agree that our roads need to be fixed. This is an issue for our farmers. When they cannot cross a bridge with their combines and their tractors, they have to go out of their way, and many times many, many miles, to get their grain to market or to get to their fields. Fixing our roads and bridges is necessary. Right now, they decided to take out one of the bridges, and one of our farmers has to go about a 20-mile route around to get to his fields and his land. But we have to do this. We have to fix our roads and bridges, not only for our farmers, but for our school buses. That's a big concern as well. And there is funding available for fixing our roads. We have $1 billion surplus in the bank, so should we raise a gas tax or should we use that funding? What can we do to put people back to work? If we were rebuilding those roads and bridges, we'd have extra jobs for people locally. This is a priority for me. Governor Branstad has said it's a priority for him, yet we haven't seen anything come forward on this yet. The longer we wait, the more it's going to cost us and the more roads we're going to have to continue to repair.
And Greg, could you continue with any ideas you might have as to how to fund road improvements and better maintain
our
roads?
Sure. excuse me. And again, I think everyone is in agreement that this is a priority, not just for the issues mentioned as far as farmers getting their crops to market and also making sure that we have adequate infrastructure for our business and industry and for schools as well. But also emergency management has issues dealing with getting to people, and concern about crossing bridges and so forth. So, I'm on the House Transportation Committee, and so I'm aware of the proposals that was offered by Director Trambino and the Iowa Department of Transportation. The unfortunate thing was, though, that the push for raising the gas tax was so strong that no one wanted to, that the powers that were pushing the gas tax did not want to look at any of those other alternatives. And there were good alternatives that needed to be vetted, but unfortunately, no one wanted to take a look at them. Now, we did, at the House Transportation Committee, our chair, Representative Burns, is a huge proponent of the gas tax, and so he brought in several people to give testimony at the House on the House Transportation Committee. And one of the things that was, I think, even to his surprise, it came out is that even if we were to go to a 10 cent per gallon gas tax over 3 years. After it was fully implemented, we would be looking at another, oh, maybe 6 years worth of funding before we'd have to be coming back to the taxpayers once again. So there doesn't seem like it's a very steady and reliable form, and especially when it has to be filtered through the Time 21 formula, which puts a lot of the burden on counties like Marion County and Jasper and Lucas County, but then a lion's share of the benefit goes to the five most populous counties in the state. So I proposed something this year, that taking 2% of our general fund and putting it into the road use tax fund pre-Time 21, so that more funding would actually get to our rural roads and our farm to market roads better than if having to be filtered through the Time 21 formula. There was also talk among several legislators this last year in trying to find ways to get parts of the surplus to be used towards giving a chunk of cash to each one of our counties to make sure, and if had we have done that, it would have been more than what they would have gotten out of the money that would have come through the Time 21 formula. However, like I said before, the folks that were heavily pushing the gas tax would not have any of it, wouldn't hear none of it, and unfortunately wasn't able to get that through. But I think it's something that has to be addressed this year. I think it will be addressed because this is one of those cans we've continually kicked down the road, and we can't continue to do it anymore.
Megan, you have a comment?
We also need to make sure that our road use tax fund money goes towards our roads and our bridges. One of the proposals for the voter ID law from Matt Schultz, that took our road use tax fund money out of that pot. We need to make sure that the money is in there, goes directly to our roads. And we also need to take notice that it's not because our roads and bridges aren't being taken care of in some places. It is happening. But with the heavy freeze and thaw cycles and with flooding, it has wiped out a lot of roads, rurally as well as in Sioux City. They had major damage and had to repair all of their roadways. But we need to make sure that those projects can continue. We also need to make sure that with the road funding, parts of those things that happen as a result is our Weiler Industries can stay open and not face layoffs when they build road equipment. We have a lot of employees here that work out at Weiler's, and we want to make sure that our road funding is happening so they don't have to be laid off. Also, we need to make sure that the projects that are being done, such as the bypass in Carlisle, when you come off of the bypass into Carlisle, that road makes a really sharp turn now. Before, it was fine, and I hear a lot of people say, why did they fix that? That was, you know, that was road use money, that was road funding, and it just created a larger problem, and it really slowed people down there. So we need to make sure that the projects that we are working on are the appropriate projects.
I would just like to add that the road use tax fund is constitutionally protected, so I'm not quite certain how other agencies or other departments like the Secretary of State's office would even have access to that funding, given that once it's put in that particular pot, it's constitutionally protected and has to be spent on transportation and infrastructure. So once we get it there, the Iowa Constitution protects that and makes sure that it's spent specifically on roads and infrastructure.
You're listening to a KNIA KRLS Special Edition News Magazine, the 2014 Iowa House District 28 race, with guests incumbent Representative Greg Hartzell from Columbia, a Republican, and Democratic challenger Megan Cerf from Knoxville. We'll be right back after these messages. Welcome back. You're listening to a KNIA KRLS Special Edition News Magazine, the 2014 Iowa House District 28 race, with guests incumbent Representative Greg Hartzell from Columbia, a Republican, and Democratic challenger Megan Cerf from Knoxville. Greg, does Iowa need stricter rules regarding soil erosion, water and air quality, and are the voluntary compliance programs working?
First of all, I don't believe that we need stricter rules, but I do believe we need to create more incentives, especially in the area of cover crops and creating larger buffer strips. The problem when we create stricter rules, it drives more family farms out of business. That's one of the things that I've been hearing from farmers throughout the district is that they're having a hard time as it is, trying to comply with many of these regulations, and they have as much invested in their farm and making sure that the soil stays, the topsoil stays where it is, and for passing it down to successive generations, they want to take care of their land more than anyone. But when we try to push stricter rules and a one size fits all solution, I think it's to the detriment of losing our family farm and our way of farming lifestyle here in Iowa. But as far as the cover crops, that's been a very successful program here in Iowa. Unfortunately, we've ran out of funding because it was so successful. One thing that I would like to see maybe change differently is there were farmers that were implementing cover crops before the government came along and incentivized it. However, when after the government came along and offered incentives, they were disqualified and they had to pay higher costs for their cover crops. So I'd like to find a way that we can reward those who have been doing things right to begin with before we came along with cost sharing. The other thing is the larger buffer strips. I think especially around our streams and gulches and riparian areas, I think that we can really see a significant change with our nutrient reduction strategy and also with the soil erosion if we had wider buffer strips around those areas. Again, I think that's going to have to come through incentives from our state government. And the nutrient reduction strategy that was put together by IDALS and the DNR and Iowa State and other farm groups, because I think our family farmers understand that they have to follow through with this voluntary compliance of these programs, or else they're going to be inviting the heavy hand of the EPA. And I don't think anyone wants that. Not even at our state government level, we don't want the federal government coming in here and trying to thrust a one size fits all solution on our farmers.
And Megan, does Iowa need stricter rules regarding soil erosion, water, and air quality? And are the voluntary compliance programs working?
The voluntary programs are not working. Farmers really are struggling with this. And it's not because they don't want to be good stewards of the land, but they're not working. I am a concerned citizen. I do care about my waterways. I do care about our lakes and streams. Part of that is having the buffer strips, having the cover crops. Right now, there's no incentive to have cover crops, and it does take a little bit of funding from their pockets to do those cover crops, but I think it's important so that they can pass those farms on to the younger generation. It's really, really hard for first-time farmers to start farming unless they have a family member that has land. And at the state level, they've been working on programs to help those first-time farmers. Also, we talk about nutrients reduction strategy. All of those groups and organizations came together and said, what can we do? And they put a voluntary practice in place, but it's not mandatory. Right now, we spent the summer out at the lake, and the algae bloom shut the beaches. And I do like to have our beaches. I like the trails, the rivers, the waterways. We have two large lakes in our district, and I think we need to protect that land for not just for us and for our farmers' pocketbooks, but for the next generation as well.
In addition, throughout the interim and over the during the legislative session, I've met with several farm groups. I've met with Rathbun Rural Water Association. The talk is, folks, this is something we have to do. We can't, yes, it's voluntary, but it's something we need to follow through on. So I think everyone is trying to do their utmost to comply with these best practice guidelines that have been put forth with the nutrient reduction strategy and make it cost effective at the same time. And so that's I think you have a lot of groups that are very much invested in improving our water quality in Iowa and reducing soil erosion everywhere from, you know, like I said, the farm groups, the Iowa State University, the DNR, the Iowa Department of Ag and Land Stewardship, and, you know, also Rathbun Rural Water. I think you have a lot of stakeholders here, and all the times that we have come together to meet, that's been big on the list, and that's been the main talking point is what are we doing to improve our water quality. So I think a lot of family farmers, it's at the forefront of their mind.
When we talk water quality, it doesn't just affect our farmers. It affects everybody in our communities around the farms. In Des Moines, when we had Bill Stowe come down, when they had really high levels of chlorine in the water, that affected the community of Des Moines, where they had dirty water. They weren't allowed to drink their water. The babies weren't allowed to be bathed in the water. No one could shower in that water. Some of our farm chemicals have been shown to cause blue baby syndrome, and nobody wants that. We need to improve the ways we're treating our land and what we're putting on our land, because it's costing, it's at the expense of us, we the people. We definitely want to move forward, and however we need to do that, if that's via the EPA, you know, the Environmental Protection Agency isn't out there to get people and to hurt and harm people. It's there for all of us. It's the benefit of the community and the district.
I just want to say just one more thing regarding the EPA. I think this situation where they're trying to expand their jurisdiction through the navigable waterways ruling, I think you'll find that there are a lot of farmers out there who are very concerned about our water quality, but they would argue that this situation with the EPA is going a little too far, and it's going to drive a lot of them out of business. And that's why you're seeing, again, you're seeing family farmers wanting to comply voluntarily and wanting to make good on these best practices, because they don't want the EPA here telling us how to do things. You know, that right now there is a real threat that may happen, and I think that'll have a devastating effect on our ag economy.
You're listening to a KNIA Careless Special Edition News Magazine, the 2014 Iowa House District 28 race, with guests incumbent Representative Greg Hartzell from Columbia, a Republican, and Democratic challenger Megan Sir from Knoxville. We'll be right back after these messages. Welcome back. You're listening to a KNIA Careless Special Edition News Magazine, the 2014 Iowa House District 28 race, with guests incumbent Representative Greg Hartzell from Columbia, a Republican, and Democratic challenger Megan Sir from Knoxville. Greg, is Iowa doing enough to help the disadvantaged? And are there problems with the current systems in place, for example, SNAP?
Well, I could answer that with another question. How are we helping those who are dependent on our social safety net to become more self-sufficient and productive? You know, the sayings, this is not mine, but it's been said before, the best welfare program out there is a good paying job. So how are we helping those who are on public assistance? How are we helping them become productive, self-sufficient citizens, tax-paying citizens? There was a study done here a few years ago, and it was a national study, not necessarily reflective of Iowa, but I'd be interested to see what it would be at the Iowa level. But a family of four making $20,000 a year and taking advantage of all of the social safety net programs had more disposable income than a family of four making $60,000 a year and paying their way and not taking advantage of the social safety net. So what advantage is there for someone who is making $20,000 a year to move to a job that pays $60,000 if it's going to actually in the end cost them more in taxes and fees and living expenses? So I think we need to find out a way that we help those who are genuinely in need, but at the same time, we need to make sure that our social safety net is a trampoline and not a hammock. It's a hand up and not a hand out. You know, the other thing is I think we need to have more accountability in our entitlement programs. There's opportunity for them to be taken advantage of, not just by people within the system, but also people. There's been situations where we've had reports of gang activity in eastern Iowa that have been taken advantage of that. Well, that's not just an abuse to the Iowa taxpayer. That's also an abuse to those who are dependent upon the system, because it's depleting our health and human services budget of needed funds for those who are on the system. So I want to make sure that our current system is actually helping people and not enabling them, and that it's not creating a perpetual multi-generational dependency, because that's robbing people of their dignity, and it's not compassionate.
Megan, is Iowa doing enough to help the disadvantaged? Are there problems with current systems in place?
We are not doing enough to help the disadvantaged. Right now, of our school children, over 40% of them are on free and reduced lunches. My opponent seems to think that every person that's on welfare or needs government assistance is taking advantage of the system. I've sat in those homes of the elderly folks who receive food stamps. They are not looking for work. They're elderly. They need that assistance. And when we start putting the regulations in place, some of your requirements in your legislation would be drug testing those folks, making sure they're actively seeking employment. Those are not helping our senior citizens who are disadvantaged. That, to me, is shameful. Part of our other problem is low wages. A family that makes $20,000, that's almost a poverty level in our state, and that's not appropriate either. We need to make sure that we have adequate pay for those folks. Taking advantage of state funding, the funding is there for a reason. It's because they need services and access to care and access to these programs. Taking advantage of these, are we doing enough for our disadvantaged? No. The Senior Living Trust Fund was taken away. We had a program for the Silver Alert for people that had Alzheimer's. It would cost the state $100,000 to implement that program. My opponent voted no on the Silver Alert. There are a lot of things that we need to do at a state level to give these folks assistance. State funding is not there as a hammock. It is there as a hand up, and people need that access to those kinds of programs. Many people throughout our state have some sort of assistance. We did have health care for children. Those people were working. Many of these folks work two jobs, both the husband and the wife. People can't always stay home with their kids. They have to have that income to survive. And right now, we have so many opportunities to help disadvantaged folks in our district, but making it harder for them to get access to those programs is not helpful to these folks.
Well, this is unfortunate because, just first of all, the Silver Alert, I actually co-sponsored that legislation with Representative Pettengill. So I don't appreciate the misrepresentation. I have never, ever mentioned that anyone who is on our social safety net is taking advantage of it. I've just merely stated that there is opportunity to take advantage of it, and there has been documented cases of that happening. I've talked to several small business owners here in the community. I've talked to one bar owner in the in a smaller community here in House District 28 that was frustrated when one of the guys comes in and buys rounds of drinks for everybody in the bar as he fumbles past his EBT card. He said, you know, he told me, he said, the business owner in me wants to just close my eyes and thank him for his business, but the taxpayer in me is just wants to scream out loud, this is not right. You need to be taking care of your family with that money instead of going after the taxpayer and making us take care of those needs. I've talked to a lady who runs a small convenience store, and she said, if you've seen many of the abuses that people have used, how they use the system and abuse the system, it would change you. She said, just come and work for me for a week and it would change your mind. That's in having conversations. You know, and the interesting thing is when I've been on the doorsteps of even Democrats, they've even agreed with me that something needs to be done because they're tired of their hard-earned tax money that's being sent in being abused by people who are trying to bilk the system. Obviously, we need to help people and get them if they're in a situation where they need help, but there's no reason to allow them to take advantage of the system. The identification, the photo ID for the EBT cards just keeps people from selling them for cash on the dollar, for 50 cents on the dollar on the streets, and then going back and claiming they lost it and getting a completely new card replaced. The drug testing is an effort to help people that if they need to get cleaned up, why are we enabling people to be on the system on the social safety net and also abuse drugs at the same time? Why aren't we doing things to help them and educate them and get them cleaned up? The work requirements, that's to make sure that people understand the dignity of having a hard day's work. You know, these are things that have received support from people of all stripes, Republicans, Democrats, and independents. And so I just think that these are common sense reforms that a little accountability in the system would go a long ways.
Drug testing our senior citizens is not right. it's not okay. People that are disadvantaged and assuming that they're all lazy and abusing the system is not appropriate. There are a lot of people out here in the world right now in our communities that are working two jobs to make ends meet at poverty level wages, and it's not appropriate to think that everybody's abusing the system. Your legislation seems to indicate that everybody's abusing the system. Drug testing senior citizens, drug testing adults that are receiving benefits is not okay. Actively seeking work, sure, absolutely. Everybody would love to actively seek employment if that's an opportunity for them. If they're on disability, that's not an option for them. So it sounds to me like this is more regulation and more overreach and more government intrusion. Now, yes, these people, some people, have a problem, but in states that have required drug testing, less than 1% have been found to be drug users. So to me, that's not an appropriate use of our state funding. And then to ask these folks to pay for a drug test, both adults in the house, any adult over 18 years old, to pay for that, that's an expense that they cannot incur. It's an expense they cannot bear. Some of our other disadvantaged people right now are young women, primarily young women, single young women, are severely disadvantaged in low wages, in the cost of childcare, in your legislation that says they shouldn't have contraception, making it more difficult for people to get divorced. Those kinds of things are hurting the disadvantaged, and I believe that we should help people and not harm them.
Well, there's a lot to refute there, but this has kind of been the way it's gone all summer long. My opponent has continually misrepresented my what I have stood for and what I have said. I have never, first of all, you didn't answer the Silver Alert situation, which I don't know where you got that information, but that is completely inaccurate, like so many other accusations you've levied at me. The contraception, I have never done anything that would take away someone's ability. No, you don't have to look at me that way. there's nothing I have done that takes away contraception. Now, if you're equating abortifacients with contraception, that's a different matter. I don't consider them the same thing. So birth control, contraception happens before the child is conceived in the womb. So that's just a matter of semantics and biology, maybe a difference, our understanding of biology. But I have never done anything that would take away a woman's contraception or a man's contraception or birth control. So I need to set that straight right from the get-go. But again, the Silver Alert, I think you're misinformed on that, because I was one of the co-sponsors on that bill that encouraged the Silver Alert. Also, back to the senior nutrition, I was also worked with other legislators, both Republicans and Democrats, to get a senior nutrition check off to help fund our Meals on Wheels programs, but it would require taking the political party check off of the 1040 tax form. Interestingly enough, we got that passed through the House with strong bipartisan support, but it was your fellow liberal progressives in the Senate who killed the bill because they felt it was more important to get political party money flowing from the taxpayer than it was to fund our seniors and our senior nutrition programs.
The Silver Alert bill, there was no funding. Those things have to be funded. You want to talk about not supporting legislation that would ban birth control and contraception? The personhood bill does that. You are a supporter of personhood amendment. I sat in on those subcommittees. And when the question was asked, would this bill ban contraception for our young men and women, the answer is yes. So maybe you don't understand the entire piece of that legislation. What it also does is, part of your legislation has been not saving the life of a mother. When the fetus is not going to come to full term, you've tied the doctor's hands in being able to do an induction under the guise of abortion. Miscarriages and pregnancies go bad. This is the truth. Your bills want to make sure that fetuses have rights before they're born. I want to make sure that we take care of those young women before they're born. Removing our Planned Parenthood does not help these young women and these families. It continues to keep them disadvantaged. It continues to not provide services that they need. And Planned Parenthood actually does more adoptions in this state than any other organization. So to think that these programs are helpful I don't think they're helpful. I have sat in on those committee meetings, and absolutely it's true that this would remove contraception choice from many, many, many families.
I'm somewhat in disbelief here. How could you sit in on a subcommittee hearing that didn't even occur? There was no subcommittee on the personhood bill at all. So, and the other thing is again, we have a disagreement on what constitutes contraception. I do not count abortifacients as contraception. I said already before that contraception happens before conception. That's what it means. Contra, against conception. But here again, as you've done in so many times in the past, you have stated things that, as a matter of fact, that didn't even actually happen. This subcommittee on personhood did not even occur. The life of the mother is already protected in Iowa code already. There is already a stipulation. I don't remember the chapter right now, but the Iowa code does not consider it abortion when the life of the mother is being protected. So I wish I had that chapter with me. I would bring it up. But the thing is this is frustrates me, is that I think you have your facts inaccurate once again, but that's been kind of par for the course all the way through this campaign.
That subcommittee happened with Representative Winschittle, with Representative Megan Hess. There were Planned Parenthood members as well as myself.
That was the telemed bill.
There are two of them, telemed as well, and we use telemed throughout this state for many, 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 many things. These kinds of issues should be between me and my family, my husband, my partner, between me and my doctor, and between me and my pastor, not between me and my politician. You talk about government overreach and injecting government into our personal lives. Many pieces of your legislation, rolling back the civil unions, that's a government overreach. Rights are rights because they can't be taken away. You cannot tell people who they can love and who they can't. And over again, pieces of your legislation have taken this extreme ideology. What do we know about personhood? It's all over the news right now because Joni Ernst supports that as well. Women are not big fans of this, and for a politician to tell us what kind of birth control we can use. Maybe you're not familiar with all of the methods of birth control, but it would remove IUDs. Many, many women prevent pregnancy for many years with IUDs. We cannot take those options away from them. With more access to contraception, we have less need for other interventions. And I wholeheartedly support our young women to make choices based on what's right for them. You have another piece of legislation that women that do have services can go back and sue their doctor for many years later. Because women aren't smart enough to make a choice, because informed consent is there. Informed consent is there. You have to have informed consent with every procedure you have. I work with women in facilities and hospitals. Informed consent basically says, what are the risks? What are the benefits? What are the alternatives? What if we do it? What if we don't? Those are the kinds of things I bring to the table as a legislator. What if we do that? What's the impact if we do it? What's the impact if we don't? Part of our population that's disadvantaged happens to be young women, and I think it's shameful that you feel like politicians should be involved in those kinds of decisions.
Well, I'll just simply say this is no surprise, because I mentioned this 2 years ago, that I believe that life begins at conception, and that the equal rights should be afforded to that life from that moment forward, that they deserve equal protection under the law. Now, what I've always been waiting to hear you is in with your training as a doula, where you believe that life begins, and how you reconcile your abortion on demand position with your practice and claim to want to be saving mothers and babies when your type of legislation that you would propose would infringe upon the rights of that baby. I don't know when life begins for you, or when do you think it should be protected, but. I've made no mystery about where I stand on when life begins. I believe it begins at conception. So the things that I propose are consistent with that. It's too bad that you weren't at the subcommittee hearing dealing with the situation where we give the rights of post-abortive women to actually seek some recourse with doctors who had abused their situation and were suffering from physical and emotional damages. We actually quoted the Roe v. Wade decision in that subcommittee hearing because that legislation was consistent with the decision of Roe v. Wade, because Roe v. Wade says that it's incumbent upon the doctor to be care for the patient before, during, and after the abortion. So the piece that we were talking about was saying that a doctor, if they have pushed a woman into this situation and taken advantage of her in a vulnerable situation, that they are liable for that. We had a couple different women who gave testimony, post-abortive women, who had said that they completely regretted. One had even lost her ability to have children from that point forward. So she was not given information from her doctor, and she had no recourse with that. So the bill, it's unfortunate that you weren't at that particular subcommittee because you would have been given the information and how this was consistent with Roe versus Wade.
I believe that life begins once that baby is born. I have been in attendance with mothers who have had a fetus that died in the middle of pregnancy. And what some of your legislation does is not give them the opportunity to have an induction, risking that life of the mother. The mom becomes toxic. Part of personhood also, and we're seeing this in other states, if a woman has a miscarriage, then they're under investigation. And to me, that's really not okay. These pieces of legislation that are extreme policies and ideologies are fine for you to believe those things, but not fine for us to legislate as a state. Again, these things happen to be between me and my pastor, me and my doctor, me and my partner. I totally believe that life begins once that baby takes a breath. With your bill, we're protecting fetuses. We can't unfreeze and freeze a baby. In vitro fertilization has been a part of this as well. The doctors are not allowed to dispose of extra eggs. And again, I don't think that's anywhere for state public policy. I really feel like our best work here is doing the work of the people that the people are asking for. Roe v. Wade was done many years ago. I had a 92-year-old woman from Sully that called me the other day that said, "Keep up the good fight. We fought for these issues many, many years ago, and we're still fighting for them again." And to me, we shouldn't be spending our time and our tax dollars on sending somebody there that really just wants to turn back Roe v. Wade.
One quick clarification, and I know we can go on all day about this. So I just want to make sure that I understand that my opponent believes that life doesn't begin for that baby until that baby is completely cleared the birth canal. So I just want to make sure I understand that.
Babies can die in utero. There are many different things that can happen, and we should not tie the hands of the mothers, the doctors that have to deal with these situations. I've had two personal clients that came in tears saying, you know, my baby is not going to live, and right now in our state, between 22 and 26 weeks, they could not receive an induction, and they were told by their physicians to go out of state to Colorado or another state because our state cannot offer services for young women in those situations, and I think that's something that's really shameful.
So then I heard you say you're okay with partial birth abortion, and that's basically what
we
I was asking.
We don't perform those in our state.
But you would be okay with it if we were?
We don't, but we don't.
Mm-hmm. But you'd be okay with it?
No, I'm not okay with that, and my personal philosophy is very personal, mm-hmm. and it's not up for political discussion. I fully support a woman's informed choices, and I will always be a supporter of young women to make those informed choices with their partners, their physicians, and their pastors.
But what we found in that subcommittee is that women are not receiving informed choices. They're not giving the information they need to adequately decide whether or not they should go through with that. And that's why I was saying it's unfortunate that you were not at that subcommittee hearing, because I think the two ladies that gave testimony would have mentioned that, or I think you would have heard it from them clearly that they were not given enough information to decide based on whether or not, and they would have, had they been given the full information, they would have chose otherwise.
Having known some of these ladies who sit on those subcommittees, informed consent is a problem, Informed consent is something that all physicians are required to do, and it doesn't happen often enough. I stand in hospital rooms very often where there's not full informed consent, but the women still are able to make great choices. Part of what we need to do is make sure they know what the risks are, what the benefits are, what the alternatives are, what if we do it, what if we don't, and that's with everything, not only medical procedures, but with everything in life.
Megan, does the Iowa Constitution need to be amended, and if so, why?
Well, the Constitution is one of those documents that was created to stand on its own. The Iowa Constitution, we could amend to add the Second Amendment. I would be supportive of that. But other than that, no. I think part of our concern with the current representation is that there are a lot of constitutional amendments that want to be done, such as amending the 17th Amendment, which would give people, you and I, it would take away our right to vote for our United States congressional members, our U.S. senators. My opponent introduced a bill that would say that you and I shouldn't be able to vote for Bruce Braley or Joni Ernst, that they should be appointed by the legislature. Looking back at the Federalist Papers, it really doesn't say that that's the way we should be going. The times were different then, and people weren't able to communicate and get the message and information like we are today in our world right now. There are very few constitutional amendments that I would be in favor of. We need to make sure that election integrity is there. We need to make sure that people are able to vote for their United States senators. There's no reason that we should be able to elect representation at a state level and also for the U.S. House, but not for the U.S. Senate. That's puzzling to me. There aren't really amendments that I would make to our Constitution at this time. I think we have a great Constitution in the Iowa Constitution and in the U.S. Constitution.
Well, I think your question was specifically about the Iowa Constitution, and I did support an amendment to the Iowa Constitution that would put the language of the right to keep and bear arms in that. We're one of, I believe, six states that does not have that language in it. And some people say, well, isn't that redundant since it's already in the United States Constitution? Yes, in a way it is. But however, there are states that are having issues with people's gun rights that do not have that verbiage in there. And as we are sovereign states, we're not one of 50 bureaus under the federal government. We are a sovereign state. It's important for us to have that in our Constitution. I think some of the situations we're seeing around the state dealing with religious liberties, where you have elected officials trying to subpoena the records, the sermons and correspondence of pastors and people of faith because they disagree with them politically. I think there is a potential for us to address that religious liberties issue in our Constitution. And then, of course, there's the one dealing with the definition of marriage. Iowans for a long time have been asking for the legislature to put forth an amendment and give them the opportunity to vote on an amendment. So I think there's three opportunities that I think that the people would enjoy having that opportunity to vote on those amendments.
Civil unions and gay marriage, Iowans are not asking for a right to vote for that. In fact, the GOP has even said they're not going to take that bill up. You continue to bring legislation that your party isn't considering, and that's one of them. If you look at the Republican platform right now, there is nothing in there about gay marriage. They've removed that. They've had 2 years to bring that bill forward, and no one has taken that up. I do believe in separation of church and state, and putting God back into our schools is not okay with me. My kids go to church, and they get their lessons at church, not at school. And so I think those kinds of constitutional amendments are dangerous.
Part of the reason why the Republicans, I think, did not deal with this is because of the obstructionist Senate refused to take any of this up. That brings me to another quick topic of how many bills that passed the House with strong bipartisan support that the Senate refused to take up. But anyway, I think that it's just kind of like beating a dead horse. They decided to give up on that. The dealing with the separation of church and state, I find it interesting that my opponent was so critical of this issue. However, it was strangely silent when Senator Jack Hatch held a prayer in the rotunda asking for God to continue abortions in the state. So for someone to, you know, be so staunch on the separation of church and state, but it's okay for people of her party to gather in the rotunda of the Capitol and pray for abortion, I find kind of ironic as well.
There's a lot of prayer every day at the Capitol. The legislators pray before the session starts. There is a lot of prayer that happens, citing a rally that was happening not just with Jack Hatch, but with a lot of people and calling him out on praying. I think prayer is appropriate, but I don't want to see that separation of church and state disintegrated. There's a reason that we have that. We have ISIL right now, and that's because the church doctrine is integrating their state policies, and we're fighting against that. I think people really want to have that separation continue.
Greg, let's start with you, a closing statement real quick.
Okay. Obviously, my opponent and I are on opposite ends of the political spectrum, and how we view the role of government is significantly different as well. So I think the question comes down to effectiveness. Which one of us has the proven record of accomplishments in the legislature? My opponent has been a lobbyist for 6 years working on one single issue, and in that time, she has been unable to move her issue past the first legislative hurdle of a full House or Senate committee. In fact, in just the last 2 years, she hasn't even bothered to register on any legislation at all. So I'm not sure how she can claim that she's been working at the Capitol all this time when there really hasn't any evidence to back up that claim. Now contrast that with my first term in office. I've been able to get several pieces of legislation through the House and many to the governor's desk on a wide variety of issues with strong bipartisan support. For instance, I championed the bill that cracked down on human trafficking. I removed sexually violent predators from our streets, restored landowner liability that was stripped out from our Supreme Court, and created tax incentives for the Knoxville Raceway expansion. These are just to name a few. During the interim, I've been continuing to work on legislation with members of both parties and both chambers so that I'm ready to hit the ground running should the voters of House District 28 send me back for another term. So I feel I have a proven track record of working in a bipartisan manner to get things accomplished for the benefit of all Iowans, and I'd humbly ask for the House District voters for their vote.
Megan, your closing statement.
Well, I have been working on behalf of women and children throughout this state, and my opponent's incorrect. We have moved our bill. It was on the Senate floor. This year, it was sent to the Kill Committee from Representative Guy Vanderlinden, and that was a known fact. When these things come to committees, they can decide to run them or not. Currently, I would prefer to move our community forward and our district forward. I am a proponent of expanding broadband and Wi-Fi throughout our district, making sure that first-time farmers and current farmers have the incentives that they need to begin their farming careers, making sure that we address our child care expenses so that families aren't going to work just to pay daycare. I want to move our communities forward with clean air, clean water, and clean land. Solar and wind power are really important to me, and these are innovative technologies. I want to move our community forward and not take it backwards. I'm Megan Sir, and I ask for your support on November 4th.
And that concludes this KNIA KRLS Special Edition News Magazine, the 2014 Iowa House District 28 race. Thanks to incumbent Representative Republican Greg Hartzell and Democratic challenger Megan Sir. The one to count on for award-winning political coverage in today's news and information is KNIA KRLS.